It's not a standard father-daughter relationship. I think they're friends, first and foremost. And of course, there's like, he's a disciplinarian when he wants to be and when he's nervous about certain corners of the world that he doesn't really want her to venture. But then there's other moments when he's like, I've taken all the drugs in the world and you can too. Just promise me that you'll tell me. You're basically seeing a young man navigating being a father. And I was able to access the young man a little bit easier than I was the father. And I just hoped that the love that I felt for Frankie would translate into something that felt authentic.
Well, hello there. Welcome to The Awardist, where we are chatting with the actors, creators, and more who are contenders this year, and we're breaking down the state of the 2023 Oscars race. I'm Entertainment Weekly executive editor Jared Hall, and my partner in executive editing crime, Clarissa Cruz, is back this week, along with senior movies editor Josh Rothkopf. Hello to you both. How are you?
Hey. Hi, Jared.
Hi. I implied that we are criminals, Clarissa, so I hope that's all right.
Well, we are sometimes, aren't we?
I mean, you know, in our own little ways, we certainly are. Well, I hope both of you had a nice holiday weekend. Hope all of you listening did as well. Perhaps you folks got to check out some of the awards contenders that are already in theaters or available to rent or stream. There are plenty already playing. One movie that's been out since late October, it has a fantastic 97% score on Rotten Tomatoes. Josh gave it an A grade in his review, is the movie After Sun, a father-daughter drama from director Charlotte Wells, who's making her feature directorial debut here, and starring the fantastic Paul Mescal, who I hope audiences know from his stellar performance in the limited series Normal People or the movie The Lost Daughter. We are going to hear from Paul a little later in the episode, but Josh, I want to start with you here. What is it in particular that you love about his work in this movie After Sun?
There is so much that I love about After Sun in general, so it's hard just to focus on Paul. But
yeah.
But basically, as I watched it, I realized that it wasn't just a father and a daughter on vacation. The film is really about one of them remembering this vacation. It's something that happened in the past. And the more you think about it, the more you realize, well, who's doing the remembering? And the more you understand Paul Mescal's character, he plays the father, a guy named Callum. He's got some difficulties in his past that are never really articulated in terms of dialogue. It's never spelled out for you. It's a very oblique film. He's practicing Tai Chi. He's very much attempting to meditate and control himself, control his physicality. In the beginning of the film, is wearing a cast. You presume he's prone to violence or makes bad decisions. And his daughter, who's just about to become a teenager, knows how to ride his waves. But the whole film is sort of pitched at a moment that you know everything is going to go wrong. It's like right before everything goes bad. There's a great sense of like an ominous sense throughout the film that I thought was really exquisite. And Paul Mescal has to really carry this film just with purely physical acting, because the script isn't going to give him the dialogue to explain it. So sometimes we see him being a really good dad, or having, fun energy at parties, or like getting his daughter involved in things. And sometimes he's very distant, standoffish. One point in the film, very late in it, we see him crying. At one point, he even walks into the water by himself at night. It's a very elliptical and sometimes kind of atmospheric film. But over the course of it, you really begin to understand someone who has demons and troubles. And this is all by dint of his performance. I would love to see him get the attention he deserves for it.
Yeah, I am with you in that. I love how so much is not said here. And so much is not said in a very efficient time frame as well. This movie's barely over an hour and a half, and they convey so much. And I really appreciated that about it, because a lot of movies do not do that. A lot of them, like to, they think a lot of themselves sometimes, and they really like to show off. And this one doesn't. It's kind of very humble in that way. And I think Paul is actually a very humble actor, even, for anyone who saw him in Normal People. Was just really, a breakout from that, and kind of gave at times one of those very quiet performances as well. I'm not at all comparing the characters, because they're very different, but he's I guess what I'm saying is he's just very good at that quiet conveyance of things. And you know exactly, you know, kind of how he feels, what he's thinking. You know that there's something much deeper going on. Clarissa, what do you think of him?
I mean, I thought it was great the way that, I mean, when I heard of the premise, I didn't think I would be able to buy him as a father of an 11-year-old
girl.
Yeah,
good point.
Because you see him all, you know, naked and horny and other things.
Yeah.
And so I was like, well, and he also has a very young looking face. But I, you know, from the beginning, you could see his character's deep love for his daughter. And that wasn't even an issue at all. I was surprised that, you know, like he embodied this father character and the sort of love that a father has for his daughter in such a way that I just forgot about the other characters. And I really believed him in this role. And I thought he was great.
I think it actually plays into exactly what you're saying, Clarissa, this idea that he is a young father and maybe became a father too young. Mm-hmm. Again, part of the sort of suggestiveness of the film, it blows my mind to realize that this is the debut of Charlotte Wells, who was 34 when she made this film. Oh, I hate hearing that kind of thing. So young and such an accomplished film for your first film. She is born in Scotland and actually posted a photo to her Instagram of her own father. This is an autobiographical movie. Mm-hmm. And you see her as the 10-year-old little girl in the photograph. And so she's been wanting to make this movie for a long time. She's been living in New York and Williamsburg and making her way with short films and other productions. But this is an incredible debut for someone to make.
Well, and you know, to that point, I think it's even more incredible that because it is so personal to her, that she was able to keep it concise and there wasn't, I mean, certainly not in the final product, you know, there's not that issue of all these darlings that could have or should have been killed. She really told her story quite well in a very effective way. Josh, you said you hope that Paul gets the attention he deserves here. What do you really think his chances are? We'll talk about Spirit Award nominations in just a minute because they got a lot. But in terms of the Oscars, what do you think his chances are?
I mean, I can't snow you. I think his chances are slim. This is the kind of situation where there are many great performances that are on what's called the bubble, right? And there are leading contenders.
It's a big bubble this year.
It's a pretty big bubble this year. There are, I think, several leading contenders for Best Actor, and those names would be people like Colin Farrell and Brendan Fraser, Austin Butler and Elvis, Bill Nighy in Living as well. But then there are a host of great performances in indie films and smaller films that really need the nourishing and the attention. Paul Mescal is the kind of situation where if he happened to win some critics awards, if he won Best Actor, let's say from New York or LA, or the film's profile started to rise somehow, I think that more people would be motivated to see it. But it just would be like a sort of a unicorn, a miracle if he actually made the bracket. It's certainly deserving of that. What do you think?
I think that he is a charming presence on the campaign trail. I think people like him. I think a lot of people saw him in Normal People, and also The Lost Daughter, which is on Netflix. And I think that, you know, his name recognition can help here. But that said, just like you said, Josh, there are a lot of big names that he'd have to bump out. You know, there's also Hugh Jackman in The Sun, and you can't discount Tom Cruise, because he was in the movie that probably the most Academy voters saw and loved this year. So I think, unless he can bump out one of the people that we named as you know, kind of front runners in that bracket, it'll be difficult.
You make a good point, too, about that, about sometimes it really does come down to the box office and numbers. And I think that that's also why people are talking about Angela Bassett in Wakanda Forever as a potential nominee. Because while the MCU has never had an acting nominee before, Black Panther will be seen by more people than any other Oscar movie. I mean, barring maybe Avatar. And that's not even me vouching for the film so much as just talking pure numbers. And so you're absolutely right. People love Tom Cruise in Maverick. And so I would not be surprised if he bumps out someone like Paul Mescal and makes the bracket.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to come back to those actors in just a second, because you said something that's interesting about Angela Bassett. The MCU's never received any acting nominations at the Oscars. But, you know, this movie, I akin to, on the small screen, the kind of story that WandaVision told about grief. And, you know, we saw that those actors, Elizabeth Olsen and Paul Bettany, did get acting nominations, you know, at the Emmys that year. So, yeah, I've been thinking about that a lot lately, and I'm glad you brought that up, that, you know, this is really the most, I think it's fair to say, the most emotional, well, maybe except for, you know, the very end of Avengers Endgame, but the most emotional Marvel movie that we've seen. And emotion, you know, can certainly carry a movie a long way.
I definitely agree with that. And I also feel like grief, just as a narrative device, is a help for any actor. Like, I think that's largely why people are talking about Hugh Jackman as a potential Best Actor nominee. His performance in, I mean, I will not be spoiling The Son for anyone, but his performance in The Son is one of those emotional sledgehammers where it's every parent's worst nightmare happening, with a kid being depressed and obviously in trouble, and the concern and the distraction that happens in his own life. And I think that it's a way of kind of coalescing everything that we love about Hugh Jackman. He gets to start off really happy and charming, and he even has a dance number in the beginning of The Son, but then descends to that like really ruined place. So absolutely, Jared. The idea of grief is sort of like a factor in these nominations is huge. I think that The Whale is also a grief drama.
Yeah, and you mentioned The Son being a Hugh Jackman's performance being an emotional sledgehammer. I'm seeing a lot of people say the same thing about someone else you mentioned previously, Bill Nye in Living. I just think Bill Nye is one of the most incredible actors who does not he doesn't get the recognition he deserves, I think, when it comes to awards. I'm thinking about the movie About Time as well, where he was just phenomenal. But do you feel like he is a long shot, or actually has a better chance than someone like Paul?
I would say a better shot, simply because, well, two factors. One, I think more people are going to see Living. It's got a bigger company behind it. It's actually getting relaunched as an Oscar campaign, even though it goes all the way back to last Sundance. And, you know, Bill Nye has his built-in fandom, right? You know, I think he should have been Oscar nominated for Love Actually. I mean, I think he's, whenever he's on screen, he's magnetic. Yes. And this is going to be the run of his life, this campaign. And also, I think that Living has sort of a pedigree about it, in the sense that it's a remake of a Kurosawa film, 1952's Ikiru, which is beloved by AMPUS members. And so I just think that the elements of Living might be a little more accessible than the elements of After Sun. All the reasons that we love After Sun, oh, it's so quiet, it's so sophisticated, it doesn't spell anything out. That doesn't equal, there's no equal sign to votes in that regard. It can't be both.
I had to stop myself because I wanted answers. You know, I had a screener for After Sun, so I could, you know, had the luxury of being able to rewind. So I wanted to like pause on parts and just be like, as if I could really figure out what happened, because the whole point is that you can't figure out what happened. And, and that's part, one of the themes of the movie, remembering something as a child. Inherently, you're not going to figure out what happened because you're a child. Mm-hmm. And I think that, that might be, in the end, I appreciated that, but that might be something that will maybe turn off some other viewers. Mm.
Absolutely. Mm. But in Living, you could tell some of the log line. An aging bureaucrat realizes that he's wasted his life. He wants to make good, but he has a fatal prognosis. Like, I want to see that film. And Bill Nye is in it. Like souls and souls. So I do think that he has a slightly better shot. I mean, we'll see. We'll see how it all shakes out.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about another one of those guys who we'll see, but curious your thoughts. Adam Sandler is a guy who in recent years, his dramatic performances have gotten a lot of early traction, and then it just kind of fizzled out. Do you think Hustle gives him a better shot than he's had in recent years?
I would say so, mainly because a lot of the campaigns that Netflix planned on doing sort of fizzled. And I'm referring to movies like Blonde and Bardo, which I think they were expecting warmer reactions to, and they were not received well. And so suddenly Netflix is like, let's do a campaign for Adam Sandler. Everyone loved Hustle, myself included. I thought that was just rousing. And Sandler's having a golden age. It's not just Uncut Gems, which is amazing. But I mean, he's really diving into real acting and challenging material in Hustle. And he's playing against someone in Guancho who's actually never acted before, which is its own challenge. And they both turn in great performances. I have absolutely no problem with Sandler campaigning. He's very quiet on the campaign trail. He's the opposite of showy. He always defers to his collaborators. It's just not who he is. So I think that he might be a factor in him making the bracket, but you know, we'll see.
And he's and he's putting himself out there. I mean, even if he's quiet, just the number of events is a little surprising to me, knowing how he's sort of averse to that kind of thing. But he's out there. I mean, and he's been out there and doing talks and doing events. And so I think that helps out a lot. I still am not sure that the Academy will nominate him. If they didn't for Uncut Gems, which I loved, I'm not sure they will for this. But I appreciate the effort, and I think he is deserving. It's a crowded year.
Yeah. Well, another one who's in the mix, in that crowd, on the bubble, Jeremy Pope for The Inspection. What do we think of him?
I think he's wonderful. He carries that film. The Inspection is the story about an out homeless man who decides to enlist in the Marines and put himself into boot camp. And so you get all the satisfaction of a movie like The Officer and an Officer and a Gentleman, or something like, even something like Stripes. All those boot camps movies are in there. And I think Jeremy does fine. Again, it's a situation where the field is crowded. A24 has a lot of other movies that they're promoting. And I don't know. I think that one might fall by the wayside.
He's so good in it, though.
He's great.
I really enjoyed his performance. And a lot of it just seemed physically challenging and emotionally challenging. So I think, again, you know, if there were 10 slots, I think he definitely would get into one of those. But it's hard to say because
it's all it's going to take is one of these guys, be it Paul Mescal or Jeremy Pope, or even Adam Sandler, winning a critics group or two, or gaining momentum from some other way, or maybe it's Gabriel Union doing something and then bringing Jeremy Pope into the discussion. That's how it happens. You know, Angela Bassett is now doing press, obviously, for Wakanda Forever, but she's made a couple of mentions of this film she narrates called Goodnight Oppie, which is a documentary about the Mars rover. Every time she does that, that film's prospects rise. So it's a very complicated calculus sometimes.
Mm-hmm. When you said Gabriel, I thought you were going to say Gabriel Labelle from Fablemans, which is somebody that we have,
we
haven't talked about for Best Actor. But I think he's up there. You know, if there's a Fablemans sweep, I could see him potentially getting there, just riding the wave of the movie.
We know from Joey Nolfi's Heat Index that The Fablemans is on the rise, which, you know, as that movie continues to get more and more attention and exposure, that could pull Gabriel along with it. And then from Dave Karger's predictions, he has Gabriel up there as well. Someone else who Dave mentions in his recent predictions post, he does not have in his top 10, but is someone who Dave and Clarissa, you both on a recent episode said there's no chance in hell he's going to get nominated, but more people are seeing it. And it feels like they're trying in some ways to separate the quote unquote, the crime, the incident from the performance, Will Smith. Josh, do you think he stands any chance of recognition for this role?
I say this without having seen Emancipation yet, and I look forward to that. But to answer your question directly, no, he does not have a chance. I mean, if you think about it like this, Brendan Fraser, he's beloved by the Academy. Everyone's falling. I mean, he's beloved just before The Whale by the Academy, and he might lose. He could very well may lose Best Actor to Colin Farrell. So the idea of someone who has actively resentful voters against him potentially upsetting someone or even making the bracket, I just I think it's too soon. We're not even a year out from the slap, and I just can't even imagine the public relations disaster that would accompany him at being a part of the bracket. Again, I say that as someone who hasn't seen the film, and also as someone who likes Will Smith's performances. I'm on record as being a fan of him, but I really think that they're going to be trying to heal this year. I think there are going to be too many people who are not voting for him.
It's one thing, though, for him to win, which I don't think would happen, but it's another thing for him to get nominated. I don't know. I mean, it's interesting because I feel like there's definitely a divide between what Academy voters will do and what the audiences, general public who are going to be watching it, are going to be thinking, because I'm not convinced that they have the same feelings that an Academy voter would when it comes to the incident, and maybe okay, but this is all conjecture on my part. I just think there might be a divide there.
I think that you're absolutely right about that divide, in the sense that the audiences and the voters have different perspectives, but I actually think that the AMPUS voters are more negative on Will Smith than the audiences. The audiences and people who are not part of AMPUS were the ones who were tweeting and on social media saying, why are we so quick to judge Will Smith? The AMPUS members feel hurt, almost like physically hurt, by what they did to the show and how everyone else after the slap was tarnished by it. And there was no way to, even the publicity team on King Richard, you know, there was no way to save that film after all that work. And no one talks to the Williams sisters about it either, because they're mortified.
Yeah. Yeah, it was embarrassing for a lot of people, for sure. By the way, it's just a note to everyone listening. You can see more of Dave Carter's predictions and Joey Nolfi's analysis of the race at EW.com. All right, Josh, let's talk Governor's Awards. The honorary awards, those actual Oscar statuettes, were presented to a handful of people, including Diane Warren. Cher presented hers, and then Peter Weir by Jeff Bridges, as well as Use on Palsy by Viola Davis. And then in a moment that a lot of people are starting to talk about, Michael J. Fox received the Jean Herschel Humanitarian Award by Woody Harrelson, who gave a very funny speech. So what was it like in the room? Because I hear it was very star-filled.
Star saturated, for sure. Yeah. It's incredible being in that ballroom. This is a private event. It's not public facing, and it's by invite only. But there were more celebrities in that room than waiters. You turn around at every table, there was somebody, and major, major people. I mean, this is the kind of event that attracts celebrities like Cher to be presenters, they're not even winning awards, but people like Cher and Jeff Bridges are there.
Yeah. It's incredible. And to Diane Warren's point, she said Cher doesn't go east of the 405, which anyone from Los Angeles knows. Yeah, if you don't have to cross that freeway, don't.
Right. And I think that the reason for that is because, and I wrote about this recently, but the Governor's Awards are actually a very geeky affair. They used to be presented during the telecast, and then they were trying to cut down the telecast. They shifted it off. But basically, it's for people who love Hollywood history and want to celebrate people who should have won Oscars, but for one reason or another, never quite made it. Someone like Diane Warren has 13 nominations and no wins. I mean, clearly should have probably won 3 or 4 times already. And Peter Weir, he's a director that's made masterpieces, multiple masterpieces. If you talk about Witness and Dead Poets Society, Master and Commander, but just never quite crossed the finish line when it came to competitive Oscars. So what I was surprised by, and what I think is really, what's really interesting to me is the fact that you see that every movie star is essentially a film fan. At first, they're a film fan before they become a film star. And so everyone there is really just wants to learn from these masters. And you see Tom Hanks like leaning in, you know, enraptured by comments by Peter Weir. You see like everyone listening to Use on Palsy talk about what it was like to be the first Black woman to get a green light from a like major motion picture studio. That was MGM for A Dry White Season in 1989. And the celebrities, Jennifer Lawrence and Viola Davis and everyone, they want to learn from these people. They want to be a part of that legacy and attached to it.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. What was your highlight of the event?
Oh, wow. I mean, there were a few. But I think my favorite moment, which was galvanizing to be in the crowd, was when Palsy came on and she was talking about the risk that MGM took on her to make a dry white season. And she said, Black is bankable. Women, female is bankable. Black and female is bankable. And everyone leapt out of their seats and gave a standing ovation. And it was like doubly important for the fact that all the people, this is a power room. These are people that can greenlight future projects. And the idea of someone using their moment like that to really speak truth to power, that's great. And none of these speeches get interrupted. There's no time limits. There's no cameras. There's no wrap it up, please. So it feels like and everyone is introduced by friends. Michael J. Fox was introduced by Woody Harrelson, and they've known each other since the 80s and Cheers. And so it just feels a lot more intimate. I think that was, if I had one takeaway, and it's why I went last year as well, you get to see celebrities sort of expose this sort of inner nerdiness, which I think that's cool.
Yeah. I hope that Palsy moment makes it into the highlight reel that we will see. They always include highlights in the 2023, in the Oscars. So hopefully we will see that. And I teased earlier that Film Independent revealed its Spirit Award nominations. Everything Everywhere All at Once leads all nominees with 8, followed by Tar and After Sun, I believe both with 7 apiece. Let's talk about the Best Feature category, which includes Everything Everywhere All at Once, Tar, as well as Bones and All, Our Father the Devil, and Women Talking. I mean, not that we need to like throw out predictions just yet, but this feels like it's going to be a year, especially on the indie circuit, between Everything Everywhere All at Once, which it's kind of weird to think of as an indie film, but it truly is, and Tar.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd throw Women Talking in there too, just because I think that's got a lot of momentum behind it. But I don't know. I mean, Everything Everywhere All at Once, I think just down the line, there's just so much love for it. I think it does have a shot in the Oscars Best Picture race, as well as Women Talking, and Tar. But I think just the feeling, you know, I'm not basing this on any kind of science, but that's just the anecdotal feeling for this movie. I think the fact that it's been able to sustain this much momentum since it came out, you know, in March, you know, 2021, I think is a testament to the love that people feel for this. And I feel like it's one of those emotional movies, much in the way that Parasite was. Yeah. That year, that I think people will be really happy to vote for it and would be happy if it won. Mm-hmm.
And I say, you know, this is an indie film, by the way. It's on the, upper end of the budget requirements for what, you know, Film Independent considers, eligible for Spirit Awards. This is not a movie that was made for $5 million. It was much more than that, but still compared to, you know, Black Panther made... on next to nothing. Yeah.
Squillions. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's also, it has the status, Everything Everywhere All at Once has the status of being A24's highest grossing film. It's upwards of $100 million gross. And I think that that's an undeniable factor in this bracket. I mean, it will be seen by thousands, if not millions more people than all of the other nominees combined. And I say that as a big fan of Tar and Women Talking. It's just sometimes it does come down to the, oh, more people have seen it, more people will vote for it. And I do agree with you that there is an emotional connection, like Parasite, Clarissa. I remember the Village Voice used to call it the passion dex. What's the passion dex of this film? And the passion dex for Everything Everywhere All at Once is extremely high, because you don't just love that film. You love, love, love that film.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially the ending, I think, really seals the deal. Interesting this year is that the performance categories are gender neutral. So everyone competes in the same category together. And for lead performance, the nominees are, well, we've been talking about Everywhere All at Once, Michelle Yeoh, of course. We've also talked about Paul Mescal for After Sun and Jeremy Pope for The Inspection. Other nominees, Cate Blanchett for Tar, Dale Dickey for A Love Song, Mia Goth for Pearl, Regina Hall for Honk for Jesus, Save Your Soul, Aubrey Plaza for Emily the Criminal, Taylor Russell for Bones and All, and Andrea Riseborough for To Leslie. What are your feelings there? Because that's a great category.
Does that work out to 5 and 5?
I believe so. 1, 2, 3, 4, five. Actually, no. It looks like we have 8 women, 2 guys.
Oh, wow. Okay.
That's cool. I mean, this is an experiment that I think a few groups are doing this year. I know the Los Angeles Critics Group is doing this as well. I think I'm so thrilled by this list of performances. And I love the idea of someone like Mia Goth, who actually pulled off 3 separate performances in both X and Pearl. You know, it's like that she's getting a little bit of attention, even if it's just making this bracket, I think helps. I don't know. I what do you guys think about this sort of gender-free thing?
I mean, my issue when I heard about it was that I was worried that there wouldn't be enough women represented if there was no boundary on how many could be nominated per gender, then that was my fear. But it doesn't seem to be the case
I remember we talked about that once in the office.
Yeah, historically, for gender-free categories, women have dominated year after year. And what LA is doing this year is they're actually going to pick 2 awards to win lead performance and 2 awards to win best supporting performance. And they're both at an equal level. And I think the implication is if you wanted to, you could have a woman and a man both winning. Or if you wanted to, you could have 2 women or 2 men. So it's an experiment that I think is worth trying and seeing how it plays out.
100%. Could not agree more with that. It's, you know, I mean, I think we've all been saying it for a while now that, you know, it's happening at the Emmys as well. It's certainly happening at the Oscars that we look at, you know, the lead actress categories. And it's like it feels like there are a lot more options for women to, you know, get those 5 or 7 or 8, however many slots there are versus the men. And, I'm all for it. I mean, I'm also all for just expanding the number of best actor and best actress nominees at the Oscars. You know, we're limited to 5. The Emmys get a bit more. I think there should be more than that. Should be maybe perhaps like a percentage of the number of films that are made or something like that, or the number of, submissions in the category. But yeah, I love this list. And if you made me pick right now, I couldn't. Because it's that good. Exactly to your point, someone like Mia Goth, I could see, coming in and getting the vote, especially if I don't quite know how Film Independent votes, but I don't know if there's a possibility for people splitting the vote. But, you know, that, I feel like that's still always possible anywhere. And the last award I want to talk about, you can see all of the nominees at EW.com. But one award that I want to talk about is there are no nominees. They just picked the winner. It's the Robert Altman Award, which goes to the director, the casting director, and the ensemble cast. And the winner of this one is Women Talking. Clarissa, you've mentioned that one already here. I kind of thought maybe Everything Everywhere All at Once would get it. But I think Women Talking is a fantastic choice.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting because it's casting that's included in that. And I think Women Talking is so well cast. It's not usually the first thing that you notice, but maybe it shouldn't be. You know, and that's why I thought it was so well done in this movie. And it's quiet, you know, and it's talky, obviously. But I think it's a nice way to reward it because I don't think it'll get the best picture. So I think maybe this is a way of sort of honoring this movie and then also whoever's going to be getting the best picture.
Well, and we may see one or more of these women go the distance at the Oscars. I don't know. That is, of course, still to be determined. What is not to be determined is what is coming up next on The Awardist, because that is locked and done and loaded. It is our conversation with After Sun star Paul Mescal. Don't go anywhere. The Awardist will be right back.
Also,
no one
more about gel coat
when the fourth round would
don't you call in the
don't touch that dial. That's right, we're still calling it a dial here because it's Emmy season on The Awardist. With the dazzling Oscar season behind us, we are now turning our attention to smaller screens to track which shows are headed to the podium and which shows stopped us in our tracks. Join me, Jared Hall, Entertainment Weekly's executive editor,
as well as EW's TV-obsessed staffers every Thursday starting April 4th as we share our opinionated hot takes and insight into the Emmys race. The awardist will get behind the scenes with the creators and stars themselves during in-depth, can't-miss interviews. Follow the long road to the Emmys with the awardist podcast Thursday starting April 4th on your favorite podcast platform, and be sure to check out more Emmys coverage at ew.com/awardist.
Welcome back to The Awardist. All right, without any further ado, EW Awards correspondent Dave Karger sat down with AfterSun star Paul Mescal. Let's get right to it. Enjoy.
Hey there, welcome to The Awardist on Entertainment Weekly. I'm Dave Karger. Very happy to be here with Paul Mescal from the beautiful and very intriguing film, AfterSun. Great to see you.
Thanks for having me.
The writer-director, Charlotte Wells, did such a beautiful job in this film. It's a very different kind of film. Mm-hmm. I'm curious to know how you were introduced to her and this film. Did you have a conversation with her first, or did you read the script first? What was the order of things?
It was the latter. It was a script first. I distinctly remember getting it from my agents late on a kind of Friday, reading it on the Friday, and quickly messaging them back and being like, can we set up a meeting with Charlotte? Because it was the kind of script that you read and you're like, I feel like everybody who reads this script is going to want to be in it. So trying to like push that as much as I could. And then I read it a couple of more times. I think I read it twice more that weekend and watched her short films, Lapse and Blue Christmas and Tuesday, which I was just blown away by. So yeah, it was pretty traditional. It was like read the script, then I had the meeting with Charlotte.
It's such a different kind of film visually. How, if at all, was that explained in the written script?
It's pretty much all there. It's like, it's interesting. I've got that question a couple of times in terms of, is it a pretty spare script? And it's 96 pages, 97 pages. And I think there isn't a huge amount of dialogue in the film, but there is pretty extensive stage directions, which I think were a big reason for me wanting to do the film, was seeing how much detail Charlotte had put into those kind of non-verbal moments, especially with Callum, where you're, especially towards the end of the film, where you're, an audience is leaning in towards him a little bit more. Mm. I just thought we're so beautifully observed in her writing of him. Yeah.
Were there any films from the past that Charlotte wanted you to watch before you filmed this? Because I know she was influenced by lots of other different filmmakers.
Yeah. We didn't discuss that actually in, because I think Charlotte was very keen for the tone to be her, like she was in charge of that. But it was my job to kind of, to be very present with Callum and for Callum to feel very present tense and not to feel like a memory piece. Mm. So I like watched some of the films that like Somewhere and things like that, which I'd seen before, so it was just the perfect excuse to go back and watch them again. But
Sofia Coppola.
Yes, right? Yeah. Oh,
wow.
Yeah,
that's a great choice.
Yeah, and Tomboy and films like that, a lot of Lynn Ramsey's early work. Yeah,
it's surprising because you're so young to see you playing a dad. Have you ever played a dad before?
No.
In any medium?
Actually, is that I played a 55-year-old man in my first ever play at drama school.
Really?
To great success. No, it was like the benefit of drama school. You get to play all these amazing characters. But this is my first kind of age-appropriate dad, I would say. And relatively,
having,
yeah.
And like, having a child opposite you.
Totally, yeah, absolutely.
What was that? First of all, Frankie Corio, who plays Sophie, your daughter, she's great.
Yeah.
What was the process with her? Did you meet her before she was cast? Was she like a finalist and you met with her, or did she just get the part and then you met
She her? Was, Charlotte was keen to cast Sophie first. So Frankie was cast and I was brought in, I think, with one or two other boys. And I remember reading with Frankie and I was like, you're a genius and you don't even know you're a genius yet. Or maybe she does. I have a sneaky suspicion that Frankie knows that she's exceptionally talented. But yeah, we did some improv games. And then, you know, I just had a good feeling from the way that the interaction went that I was like, I think it might go our way. And it did, which I'm delighted about.
That's fascinating. So she had the part.
Yeah.
And there were a couple of you that were angling for Callum.
For Callum,
so
yeah.
Did she tell you afterwards that you did better than everybody else?
Yeah, she actually told me who I was up against. And I think, I'll never say who it was, but I think she was... She was keen to tell me that it was somebody that she'd seen on the telly and she hadn't seen Normal People, which I'm grateful for. But yeah, it was somebody else.
So I'm not asking you to tell me who it was, but when you found out who it was, were you like, good on you?
I was like, that guy's a really, really good actor, so I'm really happy that it went my way. Yeah.
The movie is so interesting in its tone and in its feel. It feels very loose mm-hmm. when you're watching it. It just has an ease to it. It also has something of what I would describe as like a voyeuristic quality that in some ways we're almost, as an audience, seeing what we're not meant to be seeing. We're seeing these very private moments. How did that influence how it felt on the set? Did it have a loose feel? Did it have a voyeuristic feel in the making of it?
The making of it is like, I'm sure you hear this all the time, but the feeling of making it was very different to like the, especially with Frankie, because we only had her in front of camera for 4 hours a day. So there was a kind of kinetic energy to that, which I think was really useful because you just embrace the energy that Frankie brings. And then there was a very distinct energy shift when I got to be by myself with Charlotte, because we just had more, we had lots of time to film a lot of those kind of isolated Callum fragments. So there was two kind of, there was like A and B energy that were very, very different. Mm. Yeah.
How do you get in the mindset of being a dad when you're not one?
Like, yeah, it wasn't kind of my in to the character wasn't that he was a dad, because I think I would have been general in my choices, because I don't have that. Of course, I can imagine what it would be like. I'm my father's son and all of that. But I think my in was in the 2 weeks in the lead up. Myself and Frankie got to hang out before we were filming for 2 weeks in Turkey. And it was about kind of becoming friends with Frankie and Sophie, because I think that's actually what that relationship is. It's not a standard father-daughter relationship. I think they're friends first and foremost. And of course, there's like, he's a disciplinarian when he wants to be and when he's nervous about certain corners of the world that he doesn't really want her to venture. But then there's other moments when he's like, I've taken all the drugs in the world and you can too. Just promise me that you'll tell me. So I think there's loads of, you're basically seeing a young man navigating being a father. And I was able to access the young man a little bit easier than I was the father, and I just hoped that the love that I felt for Frankie would translate into something that felt authentic, and I do think it feels authentic.
It feels so real.
Good.
Yeah, and you get the sense, and I'm trying to remember, quite frankly, if this is explicitly spelled out in the film, but you definitely get the sense that he's not the primary parent.
No,
They're on this holiday together. Yeah. It's a short time that he has with
Absolutely,
her.
Absolutely, yeah.
Can you tell me what kind of notes Charlotte Wells gave you that were helpful in the filming?
After I'd been cast, it was about two or three months in leading into the film, and myself and Charlotte would speak on the phone once or twice a week, just kind of long form conversation. And ultimately it would be kind of me talking about what I thought was the case. And I think for a film that Charlotte describes as autofiction and as personal, but it's also like she gave me a huge amount of canvas in which to like paint myself, which I think is such a gift to get from a director. So a lot of it was like notes would only really come in if there was something that she didn't really if there was like a gentle push in a direction that she wanted to go, but it wasn't heavily noted. I think it was kind of, Charlotte is a wonderful way of like kind of collaborating really quietly with her actors, so you don't feel like it's nothing feels broad in her films, in this film. Yeah,
I know that you've been praised before for your accent work in some stage work that you've done. How difficult is it for an Irishman to do a Scottish accent?
See, it was one of those that in drama school I couldn't do. I was like, well, look, I'll never have to play a Scottish person. And then, of course, the script that you read that I was just obsessed with required a Scottish accent. And it's weird. Something it's not like it, like work went into it. I worked with a dialect coach even for the audition. And I think it's just when you're motivated, like when there is an actual like pressure put on where it's like, you've got to, if you want to play this part, you've got to be able to do this. And it was the first time that I've actually stayed in accent throughout a shoot, which I really enjoyed. I kind of feel nervous about stuff like that because you hear of actors doing it and sometimes I cringe, like, which isn't a reflection on them. It's kind of something that I've always been like, ooh, about. Whereas actually in the doing of it, I really enjoy the kind of liberation of that.
Yeah. The movie is really interesting because it doesn't spell everything out, right? Mm-hmm. We're learning about Callum and we're thinking as an audience, is he depressed? Is he alcoholic? Yeah. We never find out. Did you have answers in your mind as to what he was going through?
Yeah, those were the kind of conversations that I would have had with Charlotte in the lead up to it. And then I think a couple of weeks out from filming, I think it was important for us to kind of loosely, we had an idea that there was probably some severe depression going on there or a version of that. But then the closer we got to filming, the less keen I was to diagnose him, because I think the point to me that I find so tragic about the film is that he doesn't know what's happening to him. Mm. So conversely, if you're then kind of prescribing a kind of set of feelings or emotions onto him, I think it can become quite like clear cut. And I think what is so upsetting to him and what kind of generates that sense of feeling of anxiety and panic is that there's something going on in his brain and his body that is bigger than he can tolerate. Mm. And that was a discovery, I think, that we both made getting close to filming, which I thought was really useful, actually.
At the end of the movie, as an audience member, you think to yourself, do these two ever see each other again? Mm-hmm. I think they don't. You don't have to tell me what you think, but do you have an answer in your head?
I do. I do, but it depends on which perspective you're looking at it from, I think. That's
meaning
all
what?
Meaning whether it's the young Sophie or the adult Sophie's perspective that you're talking about. Or maybe both, but I feel like that's... what I love about the film is the amount of people who come out with the same feeling, but very different responses to that question. Mm. I think is... the mark of a filmmaker who's really confident and doesn't feel the need to explain to an audience, but it still feels confident that the feeling is going to land with them.
Absolutely. What has Frankie's response been to the acclaim of this film?
I think she's having a ball. Yeah, as I would, if as I am. I think she's incredibly proud. I think we've got to go to the most kind of amazing parts of the world together promoting a film that we made. I think it was one of the only films that we made and nobody knew we were making it. We announced it like a month before Cannes. Wow. So it all kind of has happened. There was no anticipation for the film. It premiered at Cannes and then has built its audience and kind of hearsay about the film since then. So it has been a full-on experience for me and her, I think.
How would you say making this film changed you as an artist and as a person?
I think it's... I find that question... I'll probably have a way better answer for you in about 3 years' time, because it takes time to percolate. But I think it has forced me or asked me to remember my relationship with my own parents from when I was 10 and 11 and 12. Mm. In a way that I haven't ever thought about, and kind of how demanding it is on parents when you suddenly, when you're a child, you look up to these, like, they're icons, that they are the people who teach you everything.
Yeah.
But what I think this film does is it shows you that your parents don't always have the answers, but they're expected to have them. Mm. But I come back to me in 3 years and I'll have a more eloquent answer, hopefully.
I'm going to hold you to that.
Great.
Paul Mescal, you did a great job in this movie. Congratulations.
Thanks very much.
The movie's called After Sun. Check it out.
Well, I mean, if you couldn't love Paul Mescal anymore, there's that interview. Voters, I hope you listened because the guy is just, like you said, I believe, Clarissa, he's so charming. He's very good at what he does. And we're going to have a lot more opportunities to see more from him coming up. He has already filmed a few projects, the movie Carmen, directed by Benjamin Millepied, and co-starring Melissa Barrera from In the Heights. He has also shot the movie Foe with Saoirse Ronan, and he is co-starring with Claire Foy and Andrew Scott and Jamie Bell, a great cast in this one, the movie Strangers. I believe that's one that is still looking for a distribution, but with a cast like that, hopefully we get to see that one sooner than later. I think this guy is just going to be a huge star.
And to normal people, he is a huge star.
He already is. And he does have that, right? He has that expectation, that energy about him. He feels like I'm dating myself, but he feels like a young Meryl. Like he could go that kind of distance in terms of the transformative performances, the willingness to take dares and not pigeonhole himself. And at least at this point, he hasn't, you know, he hasn't really kind of done a sort of one for them, one for me type of situation. He's committed, I think, very admirably to movies that have real significance and TV series like Normal People. So until I see him wearing spandex in some Marvel production, I'm going to say he's my pick for a young rising new actor to bet on for sure.
Breaking news, Paul Mescal to star in, no, I'm kidding. Could you imagine? The news will break the day after this podcast hits. Yeah. But no, I agree with you. He's just fantastic. And all the best to him. We're going to see a lot more from him, hopefully. And hopefully I will see more of you, Josh and Clarissa, back here on the podcast. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Of course. Folks, that is it for this episode of The Awardist. If you like what you heard, please follow, rate the podcast, and leave us an award-winning review on Apple Podcasts. And to keep the conversation with us going, you can follow Entertainment Weekly on all socials. We're at EW on Twitter and at Entertainment Weekly everywhere else. You can also tag me at Jared Hall. We'll see you back here next week.
This episode of The Awardist podcast is hosted by Jared Hall, produced by Chanel Johnson and Sammy Junio, edited by Sammy Junio. Full episode transcripts are available at EW.com. Thanks for listening.